Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, the push to get every child vaccinated, what a new bill means to parents, and what the latest survey of Fresno area businesses shows, and what jobs are growing and which ones are declining. Plus, how the mayor's Learn to Earn initiative is helping adults achieve their educational goals. But first, we begin with an update on a new community-based adult services program. It replaced what was to be the adult health care plan. A few weeks ago, we had advocates on the show to discuss the state's revamped adult day health care program. This week, we'll hear a report from Lauren Whaley, who we sent to Sacramento to find out from state officials exactly who among the chronically disabled or poor elderly was eligible for the new program and why so many of them didn't make the grade.
It's no easy task explaining the eligibility criteria for California's new Adult Day Healthcare Program, or as it's now called, Community-Based Adult Services, CBAS. Just ask Norman Williams. It's his job to explain things on behalf of the state.
Can you explain the eligibility criteria?
I cannot. I mean, I have a chart that I can show you. I know what you were asking, and I felt bad that it's not something you can roll off the tip of your head. It's a complicated process.
Even visually, it's a challenge.
There's a chart, and it has five different bubbles. Each of these bubbles has arrows going to other parts of the process.
The state and advocates for the disabled agreed on this eligibility criteria. Then about 200 nurses were dispatched to the nearly 300 centers across California. Jane Ogle is the Deputy Director for Healthcare Delivery Systems for the state. She's in charge of overseeing the transition from the old program.
Under the CBAS program, we're looking much more at medical conditions and not at social conditions. I mean, the truth is, while we would love to be able to support social programs such as this with medical dollars, we just can't anymore.
So if you have severe Alzheimer's, you're definitely in and can spend a few hours a week at a center with planned activities, nutritious meals, and companionship. On the other hand, if you have mild dementia, but you bathe, dress, eat, walk, and use the bathroom by yourself, well, there's a good chance you didn't make the cut.
It's very hard to hear some of the sad stories, but I have complete faith in the nurses who are doing these assessments that they're making the right decisions.
Across town from Jane Ogle, Lydia Misalides works as an advocate at the California Association for Adult Day Services. Initially, she shared that faith in the process.
We were very pleased that at the end of the first round of face-to-face reviews, roughly 80% were found eligible. So that was the good news.
Good news and a surprise. The state had expected that only about half of the 40,000 or so participants would be found eligible. For Ms. Alides, though, that initial good news was soon forgotten when she learned that there were still a lot of people who were cut from the program.
Every one of those is a human being with a story and a support system or lack of a support system.
She and other advocates also point to a few hundred cases where they say the state second-guessed nurse decisions.
We began to see a flurry of ineligible determinations based on a paper review of what the face-to-face nurse deemed to be an appropriate person.
The state responds that advocates are purposefully using words like overturn for dramatic effect, and that nurse recommendations were just part of a bigger decision-making process. They were never the final say. State spokesman Norman Williams knows he has a difficult task explaining broad policy that can affect people so dramatically.
One of the interesting parts of my job is that the other side is almost always more compelling than our side. So what we have to do over and over, my associate and myself, is explain the state's point of view.
The bottom line, he says, is this.
We have an obligation to be good stewards of the public dollar.
Both advocates in the state do agree on one thing. This revised program needs to keep the frail, sick, and disabled away from expensive nursing homes and pricey emergency room visits. Whether it will meet that goal, it's too early to say. In Sacramento, I'm Lauren Whaley for Valley Public Radio.
The California legislature just passed what is called a vaccination education bill, AB 2109. Now, the bill required parents to meet with a healthcare provider before getting a waiver based on personal beliefs. Joining us to discuss the issue is Catherine Flores Martin. She's director of the California Immunization Coalition. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, when you take a look at this bill, it seems very simplistic on face that parents who want to opt out of getting their child vaccinated meet with a doctor to have it explained. But there are a lot of people who feel it's much more than that.
Yes, you're right. It is a simple bill, and it has, and it does not have to be the controversy that the opposition has made it out to be. The bill basically says that if you are choosing to exempt your child from school-required vaccinations, that you first have receive information about the benefits and risks of the vaccinations and the risks of the disease should your child become exposed to it, because that risk and disease that your child might get impacts children in the school, children in the community, the elderly who may have a compromised immune system. So that choice that a parent might make to not protect their child impacts the larger community, and that's why we, as one of the co-sponsors of the bill, felt it was important for us to get this through the legislature.
What about people with the religious beliefs who feel very strongly one way or the other about immunization? I think their concern was, you know, that many doctors support immunization, and if they go to a doctor, the doctor may not approve of them opting out.
That's a good question. And what's important to know is that this is not getting a doctor's permission to opt out of a vaccination. Doctors would not want to be put in that position, actually, because I don't think many doctors would like to give, quote, permission to not vaccinate. However, doctors are comfortable providing information to a parent. Maybe that's a conversation, a brochure. Some physician offices have parents watch videotapes. There's nothing mandated in the bill about how a physician or a nurse practitioner, a PA, even a school nurse will provide this information, and I can go into that a little bit more. But basically, parents just have to receive the information and acknowledge physician or other health care provider will provide information, and the parent will acknowledge that they received that information. And then the parent is free to make any decision that they choose. We hope that given the information they're provided, that they'll choose to have one, some, or all vaccinations. However, we are very aware that there's other parents who have completely decided that they do not want to have vaccinations. Some of them, it's based on religious beliefs, and we are completely respectful and cognizant of their beliefs. For example, the Christian Scientist families went neutral on this bill when they learned that school nurses were going to be added to the list of health care providers, because they feel that that's sort of a neutral place for a parent to receive information.
Isn't this really about education, though? That's the other part. If
exactly.
They spend time with a doctor, maybe there are people out there who they're not immunizing their child based on their religious beliefs, but just the lack of knowledge. So are you hoping really to kind of target those folks?
Yes. We want to help parents who have exempted their child out of convenience, perhaps out of a lack of time to go get their child's immunizations. We want to make sure that they make that have that conversation with a doctor or other healthcare provider, and not base it on convenience, but more important, not base it on misinformation. I know that some of the opposition has said that they are among the most well-informed, educated parents in the state and elsewhere, but there's other, and that may be true, but they are also accessing some bad information on the web. If you Google immunizations and side effects, it gets you to all kinds of websites that are not credible sources, are not peer-reviewed journals. It comes up with blogs and writings from people who have done their, quote, own research. And it's not information from the CDC, the World Health Organization, the Institute of Medicine. And so we're extremely concerned about where some folks are getting their information. Sometimes it's bad information on the web. Sometimes it's just something they heard on TV or from their mother's group or on a mother's blog. And, you know, as a mother myself, boy, I didn't have the internet when my little ones were growing, my big ones. My
well, we all know there's a lot of information out there, and right. Not all of it is factual.
Exactly. So we want to make sure that they are getting their information from a credible source.
And, you know, I know one of the reasons they pushed for this legislation, you know, as a few years ago, when we've seen, let's say, diseases that we thought had been wiped out through vaccination come back. I mean, I think everybody remembers a few years ago that huge whooping cough outbreak. It was called an epidemic by the World Health Organization. And it impacted so many people, and with young babies, they can actually die from whooping cough.
Right. We had 10 infant deaths in California, and that was a huge tragedy and somewhat avoidable. In that case, those children were too young to be immunized. They were under 2 months of age, and whooping cough in infants is devastating. For you and I, if we get it, it's a bad cold. For a teenager, it's a worse cold, and chances are they'll get better. And, you know, we passed that law also to require that seventh graders all get the Tdap or pertussis whooping cough, also known as whooping cough vaccine. And so that's helped quite a bit in California. In the United States, actually, in Washington State in particular, there is a huge outbreak and epidemic of whooping cough right now. California doesn't have it that year right now, but we may see it come back a little bit because it's cyclical, and hopefully we won't see it in the numbers we did in 2010. But there's other diseases. You know, whooping cough is a unique disease, as is measles. Mostly we don't see it in the United States, but here and there we do get cases, and we expect to see some coming up because of the huge outbreaks in Europe, where they also have parents that are concerned about vaccinations. Mumps was in Berkeley a year and a half back, and that was a massive effort to contain that. Some of these diseases are eradicated. Polio is almost there. We're working in other countries to make sure it's eradicated. Smallpox is eradicated. Nobody hardly remembers that now. But those diseases are still out there. And the last thing, one more thing I wanted to mention is that this is about the individual child, and it's about the community protecting them. But the bigger picture is, as you said, eradicating these diseases. By immunizing all the children, all the adults, we can eradicate. We have eradicated polio in the United States and North America and elsewhere. We can eradicate measles. Pertussis is a little bit different, but we can certainly minimize its devastating effects, especially on our babies, if we are protecting the majority of folks.
And I think, too, one of the concerns here is when you talk about the need for vaccinations is that the people who don't vaccinate, and yes, it's they're right and they should be able to make their own decisions. Mm-hmm. But when you're out in the public, and especially if you're in a public school, you're in a public setting, there are a lot of other people who can be impacted.
Exactly. And in the schools, I'm glad you mentioned that, there is a rule. If a child is not immunized, doesn't have all his immunizations or doesn't have specific immunizations, for example, pertussis, whooping cough, if there's an outbreak at the school and that child is not immunized, then that child is removed from the classroom and has to stay home while that outbreak is taking place. It doesn't happen much, but we have had whole schools closed down for a short period of time because of that. And so that's why it's a cost savings as well for families and the schools if we are, you know, keeping diseases, preventable diseases out of our school. And so schools have a mechanism for keeping track of kids, but that's a lot of work. And at the same time, we do respect parents' right to choose what's best for their children, but we want them to have the full information and accurate, credible information, be able to ask questions and feel comfortable and then, you know, go with their choice. We hope that they will choose immunizations, but we know that not everyone will, and we want to keep the level of exemptors down as far as we can. Washington State passed a similar law to the one we are sending to the governor's office, and they had a huge problem. Their exemption rate was 6%, whereas California's is about 2.5%. In the first 11 months of implementation, their exemption rate went down to 4.5%. So we think this is a good example of what can happen when parents have more information.
What seems to be the biggest concern for parents who don't want to immunize their child?
Because of some of the misinformation they've read online, I believe many parents have concerns about the vaccine side effects, that this may have, this may damage their child neurologically, or that it will cause some other disease to occur. Other parents are concerned about the ingredients of vaccines. You know, our society is rightly aware of and interested in keeping our food clean, water clean, our bodies free of toxins and additives. But and certainly vaccines have components of the disease in it to create that vaccine. And it's a killed virus, whatever the vaccine is. And then there's items in the vaccines that preserve it and make the vaccines more effective. And some of the folks that are concerned about about vaccinating their children have interpreted the makeup of vaccines as being toxic. And so our job is to help educate families on what is in vaccines and how it works and how it is not toxic, that we have numerous vaccine safety mechanisms through, as I said, the CDC, the Health and Human Services agencies, all of the government agencies that are working together to keep track of vaccines and vaccine side effects and any adverse events. In researching for another article yesterday, serious adverse events are extremely rare. Common side effects are a sore arm, lots of crying with babies. You know, sometimes they get four or five shots, and so that's very upsetting. But millions and millions of children get vaccinations without any side effects, and they're protected, and we do not see the diseases like we did. And that is that's why a lot of parents feel comfortable not immunizing, because they don't see the diseases anymore.
Now, with this piece of legislation, which I understand now is just waiting for the governor to sign, AB 2109, how will that work as far as the parents who want to opt out meeting with a healthcare provider? Will it be their own doctor? Will it be someone else? How will that work?
Sure. Well, first of all, any parent who has already chosen to exempt their child from immunization is grandfathered in. For the time being, let's say your kindergartner started this year and you were one of the 2% parents that decided not to immunize your child, then you will not have to get a form signed until maybe seventh grade when we check immunization records again, for example, the pertussis vaccination. And so at that point, at the seventh grade, then you'll have a conversation with your doctor. And if you're still deciding not to vaccinate, because some parents decide once their little infant becomes a seventh grader, they see that they're pretty resilient, and a lot of parents will decide once the kids are older. But then you'll go to your doctor, who you've been seeing over the years, and your doctor will likely know that you have this concern about it, and you'll either get the form signed or you'll get the immunization. If a parent is having trouble accessing a healthcare provider, if they're one of those folks that don't have a religious belief against going to a doctor, then they can go to a school nurse, for example. And our health departments are also going to be available to help parents find access to someone who can sign a form. The same thing as if they needed a vaccination. If they needed a vaccination, they'll help them. If they needed to find a physician or other health care provider to sign the form, they'll help them. So a lot of physicians will have already had these conversations with their patients, or they can go to somebody like a naturopathic physician or a school nurse or their community clinic.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. There was a lot of good information in this report for parents. Catherine Flores Martin, Director, California Immunization Coalition, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. The Fresno Regional Workforce Investment Board just released its employment survey for 2012. 1,211 businesses were surveyed for this report, and it showed many of them are still recovering from the recession. And that's had an impact on the growth of jobs in the region. Here to discuss the issue is Blake Consul, Director of the Fresno Regional Workforce Investment Board. Also joining us for this segment will be Rich Morin. He's with the Pew Research Center, a Social and Demographic Trends Project. Because just as this report is coming out, the Pew releases a study that shows that the middle class is shrinking. The last 10 years has been really tough. And we have to take a look at why that's happening. A lot of it is economic based and what we're seeing with job trends and employment trends. So first, let's start with you, Blake. Now, the last time you did this survey was in 2010.
That's correct.
What was the biggest change, if any, that you saw with businesses between 2010 and 2012?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Juanita, because when you were talking about the Pew study, I would say that it actually is something that relates to that. The biggest change that we've seen is that while there are a large number of low-level jobs that are found in the survey, and there are a large level of high-level jobs, we're seeing a disappearance of the medium, of the middle range jobs, which seems to fit into what you were talking about with the other study.
You know, I've read a couple of studies, and that's what it really shows is that the middle group, those middle income jobs, and what the information I've come across is that you see growth at the very high end, and there's a growth in low income jobs, but those in the middle are really disappearing. Why are we seeing that?
I think it's the nature of our local economy. You know, we don't have the diversity of industry sectors that are found in other areas. And so as a result, too, it's also part of the brain drain that's affecting the Valley. If you think about it, we have these wonderful educational institutions that are producing qualified graduates who feel that they have to leave our community in order to get their career started. So it's almost like a catch-22 where the lack of jobs forces the human capital to go, and the lack of human capital impedes the growth of the middle-level jobs.
You know, building on what you just said, one part of the survey that I took a look at, you look at individual professions and you ask business people how many people they plan to hire in those professions. One of the things that I saw, because I'd been doing stories on what kind of jobs are growing here and what young people should be majoring in, and one of those was for accountants. But when you look at your study, this year, you out of that study, you had only one business that said it was going to hire somebody. Next year, you see a decrease. The third year, you see it coming back. What?
Yeah, I think accountancy might be one of those professions where there are people who actually become formal accountants in the sense of CPA, but it's also the type of job title that would be embedded in many other industry sectors. So, you know, we're surveying seven sectors right now: agribusiness, auto, automotive technology, the building trades, health, logistics distribution, manufacturing, and then the seventh being renewable energy. But we also surveyed two what we call occupational crossovers, and those are professional services and info technology, which would be the types of jobs that are found in multiple sectors. So it could be the case with accountancy that would be another example of a type of profession that you could find embedded in a manufacturing company. They're going to have somebody who's an accountant. Or in healthcare, they're going to have somebody who's an accountant.
What, when we take a look at the health of the businesses we have here, again, what are they saying about their ability to grow, expand, and hire more people?
Sure. It's still the case that the number one complaint is that they're still struggling. And they're dealing with the overall market conditions based on the recession or what probably is the second dip of a double-dip recession that we're going into. We're also facing global competition and in-state competition for areas where it's cheaper to do business. You know, not so much now, but in our not too distant past, Fresno used to market itself as a cheap place to do business. And the trouble with that is there'll always be someplace cheaper.
Exactly.
So we still have businesses that are locating elsewhere because they found places cheaper than Fresno to do business. And it's still the case, too, that for some specialty sectors, especially in healthcare, the availability of qualified labor is also a pretty big complaint. But at the top of the list is just general market conditions and the fact that the economy is still very sluggish.
Before I bring in Mr. Morin with the Pew Research Center, because I think this next question I'd like to bring him in to add to that. When you looked at your survey, the largest area of growth when it came to jobs were all very low-paying jobs. What areas were those again?
Well, those would be jobs in the service economy, and they could cross over by industry sector, but those are lower-level educational jobs. You're right.
Right. Service industry, retail, consumer service,
correct.
Farm labor. When you talk about manufacturing, you're talking about
manufacturing is one of those sectors that we always want to encourage because
we
have a small but mighty manufacturing sector. And so there, too, they offer entry-level positions, but those are the type of positions that actually have an opportunity for growth. But it depends on the aptitude of the person. You know, they have to be able to use the equipment and things like that.
Mr. Morin, in your research and the project that you did, what did it show over the last 10 years as far as what the middle class is facing?
They're facing a lot, and most of it, unfortunately, is not very good. The story is that in the past 10 years, the middle class actually grew smaller, it grew poorer, and it's more gloomier now than it was just a decade ago.
Gee, that doesn't sound encouraging when you say gloomy. What are some of the factors involved in that? Is it when you take a look at, I mean, we're talking about a 10-year period here, but still there's been a steady decline. Is it, isn't a lot of it is like those middle-income jobs, too, are kind of disappearing?
You're exactly right. A lot of middle-income jobs are disappearing, and a lot of mid-level managers were hit particularly hard by this recession. It used to be the first hired, first fired, or laid off. But in this recession, we saw another pattern. We saw those mid-level managers, middle-aged, middle-income, were the ones to be laid off. And it's fairly dramatic because if you look across the 10-year period, 2000 to 2010, mean family income declined in the past decade for the first time since World War II. That's one bad decade against a lot of pretty good ones and very, very different.
When you talk about the middle class and what you said as far as the middle managers and those people getting laid off, you know, we're talking about people who had probably worked in one profession. They'd probably been in their job for a long time. And when those folks get laid off, trying to re-enter the job market is not an easy task for them at all.
That's true. And other evidence underscores how difficult it is. Several studies have noted that individuals in middle-tier jobs, middle-income, middle-aged, were somewhat less likely to suffer a lot of negative impacts, but they suffered their fair share. But more importantly, when something bad happened, such as they were laid off or fired. It took that group a lot longer to find another job, and that's for two reasons. First of all, they tend to be older. I'm in that group, so I'm talking about myself.
Oh, I think we all are.
You know, it's a little harder to find. To find a job, but more importantly, remember that many of these folks, a disproportionately large number of these individuals, they have families, they have mortgages, you know, they're homeowners, they have bills, so they're looking for a job that will provide them sufficient income to meet those needs, and their needs are a bit higher than they were when you know, we were all 23, 24 and looking for that first job.
And then one of the things that you mentioned, and probably could be part of the reason why you see such a decline there, is when those folks are laid off, and you mentioned they have mortgages, they have children, you know, many could end up losing their homes. They deplete all of their resources, their savings, their 401ks. So they really do, once they try to get back into the job market, they end up often with jobs that are paying less. And so you see that decline all the way around for that group.
It's a considerable change in lifestyle for many. And remember, when you're looking at this middle-aged group, call them the 50 to 64-year-olds, not only looking at those who should be at the peak of their earnings potential, they're people who are fast coming on up to retirement age. And what the issue there is that a lot of the nest egg, a lot of the money they counted on, resources they counted on to tide them through the retirement years, suddenly vanished. As you know, most folks' wealth is centered in their house, and we all know what kind of a hit housing prices took in the past 10 years.
But both this question to both of you, then, where are those middle income jobs going? Let's start with you, Blake. We can talk about locally, and then a comment from Mr. Moore.
I don't think they're going anywhere. I think, in a sense, they're disappearing. Companies are having to produce the same good or service, spending less money. So as individual companies or corporations look at their human capital, they have to look, how do they squeeze the same product out of less people? And so the decision has been made that middle management group is where the cut can occur. And so I think that's what's happening. Now, the converse of that is that when the economy improves, or when the confidence that the economy is going to grow improves, it'll be some of those same groups that'll get hired back, because clearly they're the ones that have to manage the lower level staff. The other thing that, based on what the gentleman had said earlier from Pew, we have a lot of employers too who are expecting when the economy returns that they're going to see what they're terming the silver tsunami, because there are a lot of people who are close to retirement who are putting it off because their investment portfolio isn't going to give them the same rate of return after they retire, or they would rather see what's going to happen. So when the economy improves too, you have a great example would be like utility workers. We do a lot of stuff with Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E. They know that they have, you know, massive numbers of workers who are just at that precipice where they're ready to retire, but they're waiting. So I think once the economy does improve, as an example, as those retirements then start to pick up speed again, then you'll see openings for people who have more skill.
And on a national level, Mr. Moore, what's happening to those middle income jobs?
I think that was a very smart answer. We heard some of them. You know, the easy answer and one that's too often given is that they're going abroad. Those foreigners are stealing our jobs. But when we asked people in our survey who they blamed for the difficulties that the middle class has faced over the past 10 years, foreign competition was relatively low on that list. About 39 said they blame foreign competition a lot. But topping the list, Congress, banks and financial institutions, and large corporations. So when people are talking about this, thinking about it, they aren't necessarily targeting foreign competition as the bad actor in all of this. And I love that phrase silver tsunami, if that, in fact, does occur, it'll be interesting to see what the implications are throughout the age column, if this opens up more positions for younger people, and if which may result in some benefits if those of us of a certain age decide to retire or linger longer than perhaps we should.
Now, Blake, also in your survey, building on what he said, he talked about who the public blamed for the loss of jobs. And I think in your survey, if I'm not mistaken, what you also uncovered when you looked at why some businesses weren't expanding or kind of holding off, it was this uncertainty. They didn't really know, okay, what's going to happen, especially when it came to health care. You know, which way are we going to go? And that kind of impacts their decision as far as which direction as a business they're going to go. So when you look at the kind of gridlock we've had in Congress without any movement, is that impacting the growth of some businesses or their decisions to either grow or not grow at this time?
Oh, most definitely fear. Fear is something. I mean, if we would have the phone surveyors in the room with us right now and you would ask them anecdotally, what is the stuff that people are saying that we don't have on our list of questions, it would be fear. Fear about what's the future. And I think a lot of people, a common comment was, well, after the election, meaning the election in November, I hope that the election in November gives us a focus one way or the other. But there is that. And healthcare was mentioned, obviously. It's big for an employer to know. Actually, for some medium-sized employers, whether they should maintain their own health insurance as they do now or whether they should opt into a government plan. The other comment, too, and something that I was not directly familiar with, but the gentleman from Pew maybe, is a number of the employers also commented on, I guess the IRS is changing the regulations for S corporations and how they're allowed to take deductions over multiple years for equipment and things like that. So, you know, many of your small businesses that are family held are S corporations. So the notion that you're going to have some type of increased tax burden for health care at the same time that – and your personal income tax is going to go up, and at the same time the way that your corporate taxes are viewed, that's kind of a triple threat. I mean, it's going to make people a bit uneasy. And that those were all things that we had heard in the survey.
And so really there is no clear answer when it comes to any of this because you have a health care bill that was passed, but then depending on how the election goes, there is talk of repealing it. Then if you repeal it, how does that impact people right now?
I think you'd have to have a crystal ball for that
one. I agree.
So when you talk about the uncertainty, then that's what we're talking about. People just don't know which way Washington is going to go.
Right.
And it makes it difficult for them to make some business decisions.
Right. And it's that caprice, that fickleness that, you know, it could go either way that is hampering people who may be inclined to hire or to start spending money to gear up for a turn in the economy. And I guess maybe the insane thing about it all is that if the economy goes up, whatever the tax rate, there'll be more revenue.
Right.
I mean, if there's more economic activity, there'll be more money.
Isn't that part of the problem, though, is that people aren't spending money because they don't know what's going to happen, and that kind of impacts the economy?
Sure. I mean, I'm sure in our family on a personal level, we've really cut back, and both my wife and I are working, but, you know, you got to be careful.
Now, when you take a look at the employment survey, where are the positives? What does it show as far as growth? You know, one of the things that I noticed really wasn't renewable energy. It seems like that's an area in the future that we're going to see some growth.
I think there will be growth. Renewable energy jobs are interesting. If a good distinction would be, let's look at the difference between a solar farm and a wind farm. When you put in a solar farm, there are some initial construction jobs as the as these huge brackets are put into concrete, and then there are people who come and kind of bolt these massive panels into place, and then a certified electrician has to come in and actually hook it up to the grid and do all that. But once that's done, once those initial construction jobs are done, it's a very small maintenance picture for maintaining them. If we were down in Kern County, let's say, where they have those wind farms up by Tehachapi, those are really labor-intensive jobs. They're pieces, they're mechanical pieces that are constantly moving. They have to have crews of people who inspect them, make sure it's okay, keep them lubricated, do all that type of stuff. So I think that green energy is important. It's obviously important for us because cost of energy can be a driver for other businesses locating here. But it won't ever become a major employer the way that other manufacturing can grow, or for us locally, healthcare is a great example. That's an industry sector that is here, it's substantial in size, and it's poised for growth.
And, you know, we've heard about that for quite some time. Is there any indication that, you know, because we emphasize healthcare, that at some point you can have, you know, everybody kind of going toward that direction?
Oh, there can be two. Sure, there can be. And as an example would be, you know, how many nurses are actually needed. There's a lot of – Fresno City College is the second leading producer of nurses in the nation after Miami-Dade Community College. I think, though, that locally, the more important question for a lot of people who want entry-level jobs to think about is, if you want a position in healthcare, be assured you're going to be drug tested. You're around controlled substances.
Right.
You have to have a good work record. So a lot of kind of the soft skills that we all had early in our career, they become entry points for entry-level jobs in that sector. And that's important that young people think about that because they're not going to be able to get the job in healthcare if they can't pass the drug test.
And that was a big thing too in your survey. That was one of the things that kept popping up. Some of the barriers to jobs was really just, again, it wasn't as high as before as finding those qualified workers, but it was still in there.
It is. And I think, too, a lot of that's being driven by insurance concerns where in any industry, if you have people using equipment or things where others might be injured, it's going to become – they're going to have to drug test their employees.
Okay. We just have a few more minutes, and I'd like to have both of you kind of wrap this up for on your end. Mr. Morin, if you could tell us, when we take a look at your survey with the middle class, what are we facing and what changes do we need to make? Are we going to have to make?
Well, there are a number of challenges that the middle class faces, but there's one finding that that is heartening, and that is that the middle class still hasn't lost its faith in, let's call it the American dream. Hard work, initiative are still valued, and Americans still believe that those who do work hard can succeed. Also, too, there's a sense that this is temporary. Absolutely, people are concerned, and they're reflecting, and their confidence is low. Some might argue this is the absolute this is a wise place for the public to be. There is so much uncertainty. Bank your money, cut back on spending, even if you could afford to spend a little bit more. But there is a sense that there has been a structural change in the economic system, and that we've had bad times before, and we'll come out of this.
Okay. And for us here locally, Blake, we've talked about this year after year after year, the low-paying jobs and how do we get those middle-income jobs? How do we get growth in that area? And we've talked about it. Do you see anything on the horizon that we are doing right that's going to make that happen?
Yes. I think that the key is how developed, how educated are the people who live in our community? Even though the economy is bad and that's the number one complaint of business, finding qualified human capital is still within the top three. So if we could do one thing to improve our local economy, it would be to get more people educated. I mean, the mayor has the big push right now with Earn to Learn. You know, we have 60,000 adults in our town who don't have a high school diploma. Boy, knock that number down. Get more people in vocational training. Get more people into school. I don't have the figures in front of me, but you know, the unemployment's bad for everybody right now. But the unemployment rate for college graduates is one quarter of what it is of the general unemployment rate. So it's still the case that the more educated you are, the less impacted you are by what's occurring. So we want to get more people educated.
Well, speaking of learn to earn, that's going to be our next guest.
Oh, yeah.
And so when we talk about – you talk about the number of people we have in this community who don't have a GED or high school diploma, That is a nationwide problem. I don't have the stat in front of me, but I think it's either between 40 or 70 million people in this country who don't have a GED or high school diploma. So that's definitely impacting people getting back to work and getting back to work in the right kind of jobs.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Rich Morn, Pew Research Center's Social and Demographic Trends Project. Thank you for joining us. And again,
thank you.
Blake Consell with the Fresno Regional Workforce Investment Board. Always nice to have you in, Blake.
Thank
Thanks
you,
a lot. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. We'll be right back.
Of the nation's 100 highest paid corporate chief executive officers, a quarter received more in compensation than their companies paid in income taxes last year. That's from a study released less than 2 weeks ago by the Institute for Policy Studies. High pay and compensation packages for top corporate executives is nothing new. But on this edition of FM 89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State business professor Ida Jones says high CEO pay isn't necessarily tied to good job performance.
What's the value of a typical worker's contribution to a company's success compared to that of CEOs of the largest companies? The CEO's contribution is about 380 times more valuable, according to the AFL-CIO's 2012 Annual Report on Pay Disparity. Not only is it more valuable, but its value rises faster than inflation. Last year, average CEO pay rose 14% to nearly $13 million. What was your pay raise last year? Now, CEOs have a great deal of serious responsibilities, including accountability for a company's success or failure. CEOs have vice presidents and other officers who help them with oversight of business operations. But ultimately, the buck stops with the CEO. CEOs deserve to get paid a great deal. However, you would think that that pay would be tied to the company's long-term performance. It's not necessarily. So how, you may ask, is a CEO's pay calculated? Well, in the largest companies, CEO pay is figured out by a compensation committee. The board of directors and the CEOs choose the members of that committee. And since the members of the committee are usually CEOs themselves, they have an interest in keeping pay high. CEOs don't want to upset their colleagues and don't want to be viewed as mediocre. So, according to Warren Buffett, a man who has a reputation for being a fair CEO, during the compensation committee meetings, too often collegiality trumped independence. So I ask you, when was the last time you were able to vote or decide what your pay or pay raise would be? To add insult to injury, CEO pay is not based on performance. CEO pay rises even though company performance has been average or worse. Many boards use a formula that calculates compensation. They set their own CEO's pay so that it fits within the top 25% of CEOs. Setting high pay for CEOs differs from setting high pay for athletes and performers. Athletes' pay is negotiated based on performance and evaluation of net return on investment. Some athletes supplement their pay through product endorsements negotiated based on the anticipated impact of their endorsement on product sales. Actors, actresses, and musicians' pay is based on historical and expected returns from ticket or music sales. Not so with CEOs. Note that leaders and other business executives claim that high CEO pay is essential to attract and keep the best CEOs. The argument is that these CEOs create jobs for workers and profits for shareholders. However, this argument is not borne out by statistics. According to two economists, one from NYU and the other from MIT, the difference in performance of the top executives is less than 2%. So how does this pay gap affect employees? According to Peter Drucker, who many call the father of modern management theory, CEO pay of more than 20 to 25 times the average worker's pay reflected poor leadership. Leadership founded on privilege rather than responsibility. According to the studies, wide pay gaps can create resentment, affect employee morale, productivity, and turnover. Solutions? I strongly support the Dodd-Frank Act's requirement that the Securities and Exchange Commission adopt a rule that requires companies to close the gap between the median pay of company employees and that of the CEOs. If Whole Foods and Costco can do it, so can others. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You know, in our last segment, you heard Blake Consell with the Workforce Investment Board talk about the mayor's new initiative, Learn to Earn, an effort to get adults back in school, those who did not complete their education. Well, joining me now is Linda Davison. She is the program coordinator for Learn to Earn, and they have an event coming up this week that a lot of people need to know about. Welcome, Linda. First of all, let's talk a little bit about Learn to Earn. That initiative was launched back in April, correct?
It was. It was launched on April 16th, and then we had a public education event on the following Thursday at Lowell Elementary. And we're getting ready to have our second event. So it was launched back in April, and we're working with currently about 600 participants in the program, working on either a GED, high school diploma, associate degree, bachelor's degree. So we have them all across the board.
And why this is so important, as we mentioned, is there are about 70,000 people in Fresno alone who don't have a GED or high school diploma. And in today's job market, without those basic skills, those folks are having a very tough time or no time at all. I mean, as far as trying to get employed, it's almost next to impossible.
It is, because employers are moving, they're trending toward the idea that people are not promotable if they don't have a high school or a GED or some kind of education, basic skills and training, along with basic education. So many you will find have a requirement of a high school or a GED just to get an entry-level job.
And so for a lot of these people, especially in today's economy, they may have had a job, and if they got laid off or that job went away, and now they're trying to reenter the job market, and some of them may be a little older, and sometimes it's difficult for those people to take the first step of saying, okay, I need to go back to school. I need to start at ground one almost.
Sure. For somebody that's already had a lengthy career, say 20 years somewhere, and they didn't have a high school or GED because it wasn't required at the time, and now they have all this experience and the requirements for employment are changing. So now they're looking at my second career or the next job I'm going to have is going to be more difficult for me to get. And many of them were earning fairly high wages because they'd worked their way up in something. And now to go back and try and start at the beginning again, where they're looking at a much lower wage and much less responsibility, and simply because they lack that education and training.
So first of all, let's talk about the first step. Because that is the first step. If you have not graduated high school, your first step is to get that GED or diploma. How does Learn to Earn help people with that?
Well, the Learn to Earn initiative is that we have education advisors from all of the education institutions that work directly with our participants, and they walk them through that really complex adult education system to help them get from point A to point B. So we have about 60% of participants are currently working toward their GED, and they're looking also at what their next steps are going to be. They know that that is the first step, is to call 211, go to an event, go to the website, get in touch with us, sit down with an education advisor, and go through an intake process, and then get started on that path. We know that GED is the first step because it's a requirement almost for any kind to be employable. The next step is, now what are you going to do? Is there are certificate programs and associate programs and work training programs. So those are the next steps that we want folks to take after that to help build their employability skills.
And they get help with that, too. A lot of people think, oh, okay, I go back, get my GED, now what? But you help them with the next step.
Yeah, we're trying to counsel them through the entire process. and help them find the resources that they need. Learn to Earn is not, it's not a program that funds anyone to do anything. It really is about a collaborative partnership that takes place in this community to help our community.
And because you have so many people, you know, people are familiar that the Fresno Adult School downtown does mm-hmm. offer the program, but many of the other schools are now offering programs to help people get their GED.
That's correct. We have Central Adult and Fresno Adult, which are both very active partners with Learn to Earn and are taking lots of Learn to Earn students currently and getting them signed up. It is, and then we also have some GED preparation courses taking place off-site, but still those students would fall under the umbrella of Central or Fresno Adult School. So we have some GED preparation classes at Institute of Technology and at Heald College. And those are being handled by their instructors, their classrooms, and they're just using the same materials that the Fresno Adult School and Central Adult would use.
And one way for people to get started is you're having an event this Thursday.
We are having an education event at Manchester Center on the second floor this Thursday from 3 to 7 p.m. And I encourage everybody to come out and take a look at that. Sometimes we have a problem getting transportation needs around town to go visit a campus. You can come there and visit all of them at once and go through some career exploration, talk to an education advisor. So
that's one of the things. A lot of these educational institutions, colleges, career colleges, adult education, they're going to be there on site, right? The people don't have to go to them.
No, absolutely. You come on down and that's where they're going to be. You can sign up to make an appointment to go do your GED assessment at Fresno Adult School. You can make an appointment to go talk to somebody on a campus that you might be interested in because they'll be there to meet with you.
And again, for people who just need basic information, it's as simple as a phone call, isn't it?
That's correct. You can call 211 to get information on Learn to Earn or how to get started in the process.
And you were saying thus far, since you started, you've about 500 to 600 people have signed up?
That's correct. We're working with nearly 600 people, and we already have about a dozen people that have gotten their GED just since the launch. So it really is easier than you think.
And all you need to do, though, is just make that first step.
That's correct. Call 211 or go to the event.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Linda Davison joining us this morning with the Learn to Earn initiative. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Juanita.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.